begin with a brief prayer. Gracious God, may the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Anyway, I wore another t-shirt today to show you where I get all of my erudition, because this doesn't exist. There is no such place. So, Kelly's Island University. A friend of mine lives at, it's off of Sandusky. Yes. I've never been there. But a friend of mine has a house there, and he always wanted to start a retreat center for clergy. And one year he announced it and everything else, and asked me to come and teach, and got these t-shirts made, and nobody came. So I got a t-shirt out of it, and I just claim that's where I got my education. The text we're looking at today is from Matthew chapter 11, in verses 25 to 30. As we pointed out, that yesterday's text from Romans and today's from Matthew are the text for this Sunday, the seventh Sunday after Pentecost. And all of your help in this process has been to helping me get ready to preach on Sunday night. So I say thanks to you in advance for that. There's a third text, of course, for Sunday, the Old Testament text. So the first lesson is from Zechariah. We won't be looking at it. It's the text where the king comes and humbly is coming in, triumphant but humble, on the donkey, the ass, and the foal of an ass. That reference that we use at and think about at Advent, Jesus coming into Jerusalem, and at and certainly on Palm Sunday, the Old Testament reference for that is the third lesson that you will be hearing on Sunday. If you're going to be able to get to worship, we won't be traveling somewhere along the line. But I appreciate your help here. I wonder if section before us, 11, 25 to 30, is really two sayings of Jesus. The one, 25 to 27, the first saying, and the second, 28 to 30. So I wonder if in the Revised Standard Version, if two of you, one would read that first section, one would read the other. Two sayings of Jesus, 25 to 27, who will read that? Someone? Preferably somebody who can read English. Is there anybody here? Why don't you, please?
At that time, Jesus declared, "I thank thee, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that thou hast hidden these things from the wise and understanding, and revealed them to babes. Yea, Father, for such was thy gracious will. All things have been delivered to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone who to whom the Son chooses to reveal him."
Okay, and then 28 to 30. Someone would read that?
I can.
Sure.
"Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light."
Okay. Those are the two sayings. Let me give you a little background for this. We said yesterday how we have always little snippets and we don't always know what the context is. Chapter 11 begins with John the Baptizer sending his disciples over to Jesus and saying, "Are you the one that should come, or are we waiting for somebody else?" And you may recall that Jesus began his answer by saying, "Well, tell John what you're seeing. The blind are seeing, the lame are walking. There's all lots of stuff going on. You ought to be pretty assured about that." And then Jesus goes on to do some of the woes. Woe to them. My translation that I have in front of me is "Alas for them, Chorazin and Bethsaida and Capernaum, because they had a chance to see and hear Jesus, and they missed what was going. It's going to be easier for Tyre and Sidon, the outside places. Like if you lived in Chicago, that'd be like Cicero and South Chicago Heights or them. It'll be easier for them than it would be for Capernaum and Chorazin." Bethsaida. So because they had missed what was going on. And then Jesus moves on into this section. They will be judged because they missed what was going on. But then he goes on, and at that time Jesus said, I thank thee, Father, in my translation here, NEB, Lord of heaven and earth, for hiding these things from the learned and wise and revealing them to the simple. Yes, Father, such was thy choice. Everything is entrusted to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son but the Father, and no one knows the Father but the Son, and those to whom the Son may choose to reveal him. After this, in the beginning of the next chapter, Jesus has Matthew puts Jesus into those two events where the working on the Sabbath, where the Sabbath is called into question. His disciples are picking corn on the Sabbath, and also he's healing on the Sabbath. So that's, you know, sort of the context. And often in the, you find in the gospel lessons, stories are put in that order, just for their dramatic effect. They're not anything less than important revelation of God, but the sequence tells you something about what you're getting into when you hear these things. In a little bit, I'm going to ask you to get into groups again and for just a short while and respond to some of these. But let me tell you a little more about them too, so you can maybe be irritated or whatever it may be in the process. These are two independent sayings, and they were not original with Jesus. They're found in many other places, mostly in what's called Jewish wisdom literature. Wisdom literature tends to be more the mystical writings. You know, we would refer mostly to books like Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and things like that. But the ones that didn't make it into our canon of the scriptures, you'll find these references a number of times. So it wasn't anything original of Jesus, but that happened many times when he took something that was found elsewhere and gave it a new kind of a meaning. A couple of questions that I'd like you to, let me see, there was one more thing I want to say about the text itself. Oh, that it has to do with revealing. If you notice, the verb reveal is found twice in there. It isn't, what was going on was some way of things being told that hadn't been known. And that process is an important, that part of the text I think is sort of important that you catch that revelation dimension of it. Then I was going to ask you to read one other section that we'll read together out loud before you get into groups to talk about it, where I believe, anyway, St. Paul picks up this same idea. Would you turn to the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, in verses 18 to 31. It's a rather longer section. If someone would be willing to read that for us, I'd appreciate that. I'm not getting much Scott Hazerud approach this morning, you know, it's all being loaded on you, but in a little while you'll get your chances for sure. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 to 31. Somebody, yeah, please.
For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart. Where is the wise person? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than humanity, and the weakness of God is stronger than humanity. For consider your call, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. God is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom, our righteousness, and sanctification and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast of the Lord.
Okay. You may remember that. You've heard that read in scripture in worship services a number of times as well. Okay. Well, let me ask you to sort of play with that text well, and we'll share a little, come back, and then we want to get into that second part, that second saying of Jesus too, about the weary and the heavy laden too. A couple of questions, if you would. I'm going to again ask you to get into just a group with one other person or two other persons, very small groups, just for a short time, and ask yourself, what's your first reaction to the text when you read this? What's your first reaction to that text? Then, secondly, who do you think Jesus meant by the wise and educated, and by the simple or the babes? Who do you think Jesus meant by that?
Pharisees.
No, that, yeah, but that's what you're going to share in your group, and it might be different ideas. That'd be great if there are. But then the next question is, who are those people today? Who are the wise and the educated today, and who are the simple or the babes today? Well, as if you haven't got enough to do, what are the things that are being revealed? The text says, from hiding these things from the learned and the educated. And then down below it says, this was your choice, Father. Everything is entrusted to me by the Father. What are those things that Jesus is talking about here? What do you believe those are? Okay, you got the questions again? Your first reaction to it, and then who are the, in Jesus, when Jesus was talking, who do you think he meant? Whom do you think he meant? By the educated and wise and the simple, who are the educated and wise today, in your opinion? And finally, what are those things that Jesus is talking about? Interesting things about that exercise, first of all, is to walk back in the room and hear all that talking going on. That's really good babble sounds, you know. It sounds really good. And the other is, when I walked up to my chalet and came back, and people would say, I thought you were teaching Bible class. You know? I said, well, they don't need me. They're doing very well. Well, what questions did you come up with? I assume you did.
Well, I thought we were supposed to come up with the answers.
The second question then would be, what answers did you come up with? The questions might be more interesting than the answers, but anybody, what did you get into that you feel like sharing so that everybody could benefit or even get into the discussion? Anyone? Well, first question, what was your reaction to the text? Does anybody want to share any answers to that? My reaction was first time reading again was, well, obviously, I'm one of the simple. I always want to be one of the good guys. Obviously. Okay. Anybody else? What other reaction?
Yeah.
All right.
I think I got hung up with the word revealing. Because I remember a couple of years ago, Ray Martin was here. And
yes.
He was talking about the revealing of God to us little by little,
mm-hmm.
a dynamic
mm-hmm.
revelation rather than all dumped on us.
And ongoing.
Yeah.
Hope to have Ray back next year. He was good. Okay, so that's your reaction. Anybody else?
Just that whole thing that kind of leads a question to whom the Son chooses to reveal.
Uh-huh.
That always kind of leads a question, who is he not choosing?
Who's in and who's out?
What it means?
Yeah, is that what it means? Good question. Yeah.
I kind of question the life at the end of life.
Oh, okay, you're in the second part. Okay, mm-hmm. Sure. We're going to come to that. Okay. Somebody else.
I was this business of being of hiding it from the, you know, the whoever, however it's worded there.
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me.
Can't hear.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking more of the God not intentionally hiding it, but it being hidden from these people by their own blindness. Kind of like I remember way back in the dark ages when I was in freshman or sophomore in college, and the editor of the school newspaper wrote a very scathing article about the policies of the school, training strong backs and weak minds for the football field, and things like that. And the president of the college, understandably, was quite upset and called him in, and his first question was, is there some hidden meaning in this? To which the student said, no, absolutely not. All the students knew what he was talking about.
That's interesting. Someone else? Anyone else?
Seems to me like the second part of this is sort of an answer to the first. The question of who. And we get so taken up with the who, and then Jesus says, come.
Okay.
It's a simple answer with the things that we get so disturbed with.
All right.
In our Christian lives. The simple is, come unto me.
Okay. Over there.
I think it also goes back to what this gentleman was saying about revealing the scripture, the knowledge to us, or his wisdom to us in a variety of ways, and that we expect to grow so much when we are in a classroom situation where there is a knowledgeable leader or one who has had a lot of experiences, and sometimes we grow the most in the most simple ways from the most insignificant ways.
Thank you. Let's jump into that second question. Whom do you think Jesus meant by the wise and the simple when he was sharing with them? What's your understanding of that?
Well, there were only three wise men, weren't there?
All right. Dan Erlander always says there, it doesn't say how many are. He always says there are 17. He just likes that figure. Right? You can choose your own figure. It could have been 32. But however, it was a limited group, right? Oh, you have to wait till the... will you be here for the... how many of you will be here for the announcements tonight? For Vespers. How many will not be here for Vespers? Oh, dear. I'll talk to you people privately after a while. I can't spoil what Tom Stuhlberg has set up for tonight. It'll be fun, what it had to do with your question. Somebody else, whom do you think Jesus had in mind? There's no big, we're talking about our impressions of it. Then when you share your impression, that's the right answer.
I think our fear might be to limit it too much to a class or a group of people, to label it that way. Mm-hmm. But perhaps it's more appropriate to keep it a little broader and to... place that label upon anyone in any group who considers themselves at a point where they no longer need any outside assistance or advice. And so at that point, then they themselves would be closed off to this message.
Okay. And do you think that was obvious to those people in that day who some of those may be?
Maybe organized church back then.
Okay.
Religious leaders.
So who
he's referring to.
Yeah.
I look at it kind of that the wise men are, like I teach science, and in a way I always base everything on observation, evidence, and facts, and that wise men tend to do that. But that in fact, coming to Christ is not a matter of wisdom, it's a matter of faith. It's an affair of the spirit and the heart. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why he said, that the world doesn't know God through wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Somebody have a hand over here? Thought I saw one. Excuse me. Anyone else? Whom do you think Jesus meant? Okay. Well, whom do you think it is today? How would you describe those people?
Theologians.
Pardon?
Theologians.
Well, it usually starts with pastors and then theologians, but you can start the other way around. Especially smart bottom ones.
Just about anybody that sits around in a Bible study.
What about people who lead a Bible study? That's even... All right.
One person's name just leaps to my mind instantly as Carl Sagan.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Well, couldn't you include people of authority?
What do you think?
Governmental.
Whoops. It's no reason to be cut off. That's why I don't understand.
It happened once yesterday.
Okay, they must be monking somewhere. It wouldn't go off. That's the inside of here, the fire alarm. But it would continue, and it would kick on the fire alarm outside. Okay. But I'll be glad if the sprinklers do start. Yeah. They're supposed to. All right. Yes?
I think the people who sit around in the Bible studies aren't the wise ones. They're the ones who admit that they don't know and they're seeking.
All right. So you're saying it depends what's going on in the group, huh? Somebody had a hand here? Yeah.
Yeah, I just try to always take this someone down to a personal level. I find many times myself, I really believe I know exactly what's going on. I just got this picture so clear. And I really understand it all. And I get a little overconfident with that. Mm-hmm. Presumptuous. Mm-hmm. I think it alludes to something I said yesterday in Bible study where sometimes we believe in that. If we go back and forth, but we're not consistent with this all the time. Mm-hmm. And I find that it applies, if I look first at myself, then I find enough there. I can still point around some others, but I have a little expression I got, and I start pointing fingers at others. I found as I look, it's impossible to point to something else or someone else without having three pointing back to me. Mm-hmm. And being aware of that.
We
all fall in that category. Go back into Paul's Roman. We all fall into it's all falling short of the glory.
We're all talking about the wise. How about the simple? Who are the simple?
The learners. That's a trifle.
Learners, okay.
I think with few exceptions, all of us are the wise and learned sometime, and all of us are the simple. Mm-hmm.
And how would you define the simple? I mean, what are the dimensions of being simple according to this text?
Well, we recognize we can't find the answers we're searching for. We have no other place to turn. Mm-hmm.
I think of my mother, who had what I call simple faith. She focused on Jesus and was able to get rid of all the rest. And it was almost a childlike faith, but it was uncluttered with a lot of stuff that I tend to put onto Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think.
But in a way, isn't this text forcing us to look at that as well and say, at that point, could we be clinging to that and say that that is our wisdom?
What is that?
Well, this narrowness.
Simple.
Oh, okay.
A narrowness. And saying, I keep all this other stuff out. And at that point, it seems this text reverses that on us with this, you know, and that's God's gracious will. As soon as we latch on to something and say, I don't need the rest of this stuff, this text convicts us. Or if we exist at the other extreme, we're saying, I have all this under me, I don't need anything else either, the text convicts us as well. Because then no longer do we need the gracious will. We don't need that grace because we've already fixed it for ourselves.
So what are the things that are being revealed in that context? What's the things that are coming out from everything that Jesus had? What do you perceive those to be?
The gospel.
Pardon?
The gospel.
Gospel? Okay.
And that gospel flows through us as servants.
Okay.
That we allow it to flow through in as good a form as possible.
Okay. Somebody else?
Death and resurrection.
Death and resurrection. I think we go back, if this is, by Matthew's choice, the climax of the answer to Baptizer's question, then it seems to me it has to do with all of those things, but also in this context, that those who missed what was going on, that were in touch with Jesus but didn't understand, they saw the miracles, they heard the voice, but didn't catch on to what's going on, that they had missed that there was something more, infinitely more, to the presence of Jesus than the incidental things that they saw. That there was long-range, long-term, foreverness in what Jesus was about, in revealing the gospel, the good news about God. You ought to know God. And I've come to reveal him, to open up the view, the picture, open up the window, the door, whatever it is about God. And so it seems to me it has to do with people who had a chance and missed as being the ones who tended for whatever reason to be wise. And the simple ones who are the ones who caught it. And as you said then, that it embraced them and made them into new people. Contention of some of the commentators on this, who would be, depending on what day, I suppose, part of the wise or part of the simple, is that it probably was the poor of Jesus' day who were the simple, not because they were poor, but because often poorness forces the connection to be made. They don't have, often when we get older, and this may have been your mother's case too, we don't have the time or maybe the opportunity to be fussed with lots of other stuff. And often, or someone, the commentator said, the wise may well be those who are bothered by the question, how do I get to know the will of God for my life? That maybe that question is the one that gets in the way of being captured by the gospel. Or the second question like it, you know, and if I did, what would I do? Would I do anything about it if I knew? That might be a middle class luxury to be able to sit around asking that question. And that the poor, who may only be able to face, where's my next meal coming from? Or what do I do with my kids? We belong to a parish in Chicago, and the mothers of the black children in that parish, the mothers, you've maybe heard me say this before, felt that if they got their daughters to age 7 without being raped, were good mothers. That doesn't allow a lot of time for other kind of stuff, you see? And maybe that kind of simplicity of the poor, I don't think Jesus is calling us, you know, to venerate the poor and put them on a pedestal, or calling us to be like them so we don't have the food, but there is something about that kind of poorness, which, by the way, in the early part of Matthew in the Beatitudes comes through quite clearly, remember? It is the poor of spirit as well as otherwise that will inherit the rule of God. And so that's why it seems to me we might learn from people of our own cities who are nearby, who are poor, or we might learn from the handicapped, whatever we mean by that. We might learn from the poor, the people who are distressed or whatever that may be, or the poor of Central America, Asia, of Africa, and all of that. Again, not because they are more godly, but because by God's grace, the unaweaned were the poor who understood that being poor meant you could be closer to God. And accepted that blessing that came from it, all the while not wanting to stay poor. Yeah. Here was first and then.
Something that really bothers me, and that is that I have the feeling so often that we want everyone to have arrived at the same state of erudition in regard to interpreting the Bible.
Sure.
And there are obviously people for whom it could be reduced to a few key verses, and that's enough for them. That's their faith. They don't need to inquire further. On the other hand, to some people, Kierkegaard speaks very clearly, and I would certainly hate to say that Howard Hong, you know, is one of these people who is just pretentious and wise in his conceits and that type of thing, because Kierkegaard does speak to him.
Sure.
That there are some people who inquire further. Perhaps there are some people who should go further and don't, and others who try to go further and shouldn't.
Sure.
But we're all at different levels, and not just in our growing. I mean, that's as far as we're meant to go.
Sure.
Someone who has a very simple faith, for them, that may be exactly what they should have.
And doesn't that make then the community of the people of God all the more important? So not only we are satisfied, dissatisfied where we are, but that we accept all of those levels and learn from one another learn from your mom the value of that, but knowing that maybe for ourselves that would be a trap or whatever it may be. That's, so it is that sharing among us at all and accepting of all those different places that I think is so difficult. I think that's the thing that you're underscoring. Sure. Yes?
It seems to me this ties in with it too, that it's a recognition of our inadequacy in whatever area it might be, whether it be health or finances or intellectual ability or whatever it happens to be, and a need for a power that is stronger than us, the AA kind of picture that forces us back upon the God who indeed can empower us to be what we need to be in that particular situation at that particular time. And that so often we miss that sense that no matter where we are, there's all of us have those needs, and if we can recognize that we have that need for God to be a powerful part of our life, His mercy, His love, His forgiveness, His empowerment.
Yeah.
When you think culturally, we talked a little bit about this in our group, that everything is geared toward you can do it, you are number one, you are the best. We negate the need for God culturally, I think, in the United States or in the West. Thus, it's even harder for us to let go of ourselves, or to let go of my abilities, which I think are God-given. And
it's a struggle to affirm all of God's blessings, which are, that word is, it's a serious word for me, like this place and everything else, and yet not be trapped by them all at the same time. To have a gift, as you were saying, to understand more or less, both gifts, and not be trapped by that. That leads me to say, and I want to get into that next part of the text because I need help there, I suspect maybe that today, first of all, yes, theologians, yes, clergy, seriously, but also psychologists. Awful lot of the preaching that I hear is a good dose of psychology with a little theology mixed in. And I am bothered by that. I've been in therapy. I'm grateful for psychological insights and all of that. But I'm really worried if we are being covered over with more psychology than we are theology. And they are, I don't mean to say now there's one here and one there. It's often intertwined. But that's a concern. Maybe Leo Bascaglia and maybe Scott Peck and other people are part of the educated one. I don't mean they're bad people, human beings or something like that, but maybe they are part of the trap that we could be taken into too. I think I keep saying that ever since Reader's Digest, when we start getting our pop psychology and pop theology and everything from little articles cut up in little pieces. How about the next text? Come to me, all those who work hard, whose load is heavy, and I will give you relief. Bend your necks to my yoke and learn from me. I am gentle and humble-hearted, and your souls will find relief, for my yoke is good to bear. My load is light. When Barbara Rossing said, oh, is that the text for Sunday? Lucky you, she said to me, in contrast to your feeling about preaching on Sunday. Why? Why is this part of the text a pretty popular one? Anybody?
Hope.
Hope, okay.
It's a promise, a commitment.
Okay. Once again, I think I identify with those people. Sure, I'm weary, I'm overburdened, you know. So I'm one of the good guys once again. And I come out of the text pretty good. I'm going to get help. Trouble is, I don't think the text means that. I don't think it has... It certainly has that impact on us. And there's where I'd say, you know, let the meanings come wherever they are for anybody at any level. But I don't think Jesus was talking about carrying a problem. I don't think Jesus was talking about having too many tasks tomorrow. I think he was talking about the people who were struggling to make their own way under the law and therefore were heavy burdened. And therefore, we're oppressed. And that's why the next stories, I think Matthew stuck in there to say, hey, there's freedom from that law. And that freedom is in Jesus Christ. The yoke was not Jesus' image. It was a popular image. You know, as I said, it came from wisdom literature. And the rabbis used it a lot. The difference was between which yoke will you pick? Are you going to struggle it through and try to work it all out, get the answers and all that, as the educated wise did too, and that's where your connection was made between these two parts, or are you going to take Jesus' yoke, which is lighter and easier and has to do with love, to love God, to love one another, and therefore also to love yourself. That yoke has all kinds of ramifications and, quote, difficulties. And I think we instinctively as humans feel how tough that is. And I think this text is saying that's our problem. It's where we are now without Jesus' yoke that is really tough, of trying to work out all the answers. Or, you know, if I go to Bible class, then I'm closer to God. If I go to Palestine, I'm closer to God. Both of those are not true. Or if I am ordained, I'm closer to God. Or if he is ordained or she is ordained, she's closer to God. All of those things on the outside. When the simplicity of the call, and therefore the complexity of the call, is to love. If Jesus' yoke is to love one another, and to be about the love that God has first given us. This is a Johannine. This is not quoted from John in Matthew here. This is the only time, by the way, that this occurs in scriptures. But it is Johannine, because the Johannine was dependent on Jewish wisdom literature. And here Jesus is going back also to Jewish wisdom literature. It's like the mystics almost at this point that he's talking about. And yoke is a mystical word, but it is, you know, it's not, that doesn't mean it's got hidden meanings, but it isn't, doesn't mean that it isn't discernible. And so we use this an awful lot about, okay, well, don't get overworked and relax and all that stuff, and that's part of it too, but I think that the text is mostly about whether or not in some subtle ways we are trying to work it out all by ourselves, when really the gift has really been given, and the yoke that we should willingly put on and be tied up with Jesus and pull the world with us is the yoke of love. And so in a sense there are lots of psychological insights that I hope we never stop calling God insights, therefore theological, who cares what name it is, but that it is of God to work in that direction. What's your reaction to that? For it is your souls, it says here, will find relief. Not some, you know, abstract part, but the wholeness of your being. Not simply that you will have less meetings tomorrow, or you'll have less constipation, or whatever it is that's bothering you, but that you will have a wholeness in Jesus Christ that will give you the ability to put up with meetings, put up with constipation, put up with whatever else it may be, because God's promise isn't always relief, meaning absence of. That's where the TV evangelists do us in. Now, send money in, listen to this, you get a dose of God, you'll get a dose of money, you'll get a dose of health and all that stuff. And that promise is hard to find, connected with the person who died on a cross. He followed God and didn't end up with money. Somebody in the last class said, I think the wise are the rich, the corporate leaders who've made it. They don't need anything. Just, they don't care about these questions. All I'm talking about is my next bottom line and up the ladder. Or the yuppies who can afford a $100 counselor in order to have a problem. Because, you know, really, most of our society is ill at ease if it doesn't have a problem. We are problem solvers. The culture has become problem solvers probably for the last 200 years.
I think a couple things.
Sure.
One, I am a little disturbed in your statement that the Bible study, we're not finding ourselves closer to God or something else. That is not the answer. For some people, mm-hmm. I think we have to be very careful with that. Mm-hmm. I think we have to be very careful and say there is that individualistic personal relationship also. And for some people, that is a part of their belief. That is a very important part of where that is.
But my first word was because.
I'd even go so far as to say that for them, it's very important for some. And because they have that sense.
But then it's
where they don't have it, they're not.
Right. But borderline earning your way. And I warn against that wherever we go, because I think then it flips them back into the other way. It isn't because the power of God is there.
But don't we all fall short into that trap?
Amen.
Whatever.
Amen. But that's what the community of faith is, to remind one another is where we are falling short, lest we be led astray. You know, that's part of it. So it comes back to the grace again. It's all, that's why my word that I would stress and underline in that sentence would have been because. Surely, surely, surely. That God is present. But God is present in that baptized person too, because the Word of God has come to live in her. Jesus Christ lives in her. And that's there, and I really believe that. Just as I believe the power of God is here, in the gospel that is contained in here. There's no question about it. But I could become so enamored with her to make her the reason. Because I know you, I am closer to Jesus. And that because would bother me. I'd like to know what that because is about. That's the thing I'm talking about. And people who say, you know, I was there in Palestine and walked where Jesus walked. Well, Jesus walks here. We better believe it, you know. he's right with us, or he is no place. And I'm not again Palestinian trips, but I always look at the ads and chuckle a little bit to see what they're really offering. Because they usually con us a little bit and saying, you know, you can get closer to God over there. And I suspect that. But I'm for being close to God wherever we are, and certainly in, for loads of people in biblical study, mainly because we even call upon and sense the presence of God there. I wouldn't find that a bit. Okay? Somebody else?
I have a little problem with the comment you made about corporate leaders. I'm involved in a large corporation in a leadership role.
Sure.
And I'd say I really don't discern any difference in distribution between the people that work in the shop and the people that work in the boardroom.
Okay.
And the percentages of those who search for and follow mm-hmm. Christ and those who have no room for that.
Okay. That's good. That's a good witness. I'm glad to hear it.
To follow up on that, mm-hmm. It would seem that if that theory, if one would hold to that the corporate leaders are somehow and the yuppies are somehow separated from the poor, which they are in many ways, but that they can't hear the gospel. Therefore, to preach to them, does that mean that in our preaching we have to make them poor to hear the word?
Not for me.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
Sure.
So I wouldn't want to push that point too far.
That's sort of biblical.
Drive it too far.
It's sort of biblical.
Biblical is poor in spirit. And
oh, no. No.
Poorness in spirit.
There is that, too. There's also the poor. And the rich in the text, not just poor in spirit. We've taken that text and made fun out of it. But I mean, we turned it over into spirit. But there are other texts where it's explicitly the rich and explicitly the poor. Oh yeah.
But I think we have to be careful that it's when the richness is controlling us, we are not controlling our riches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes the difference, it seems to me. In terms of understanding that text, or our poorness is controlling us instead of, you know, our being in control of our life, in the sense that isn't all to my life. That isn't all of my life. My life is more than my just being poor.
Sure. No one gets to heaven because they are poor. No one goes to hell because they are rich. But both of those can be traps for both. And as we say that about the poor who give up and say, I'm going to rip up everybody because I need something, the heck with everything, and I would say that, I would also say the poor have a big temptation, the rich have a big temptation, and the rich happen to be me. I'm one of those. I'm not a corporate leader, but I'm rich. No question about it. And anybody who comes to Holden is rich. I would include those. This fellow used that illustration. Apparently he knows a lot of people that he's working with. I don't know about his ministry, pastor. But I wouldn't back away from warning about how that would trap any one of us, and certainly it might be reasonable at least to think that the more we have, the more we're tempted, the more we are tempted by. And that for me is, you know, more things I own, not only whether the salary is big or whatever else.
Or the more talents we have.
Talents, absolutely. Add all of that, right? Sure.
The TV evangelist is hung up with the idea that their reward.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The reward is
showing that you're with God, right? Thanks very much.